enough. A couple days later, as I was typing away on a freelancing skills test and Aaron was watching a movie on his laptop, Corey said something that neither Aaron or I were prepared to hear. He cleared his throat, breaking the usual evening silence while we all did our own thing, and asked for our attention. "Guys, I have something to tell you. I don't really know how to say this, so I'm just going to come right out with it. I've been doing a lot of thinking lately, and I think it's best for me to go home early. Katie's buying me a plane ticket tonight, and I'm leaving tomorrow." End of chapter 21. Chapter 22. Farewell. Bangkok, Thailand. If at some point you don't ask yourself, "What have I gotten into?" then you're not doing it right. Roland Gell. September 20th. The news devastated the group. It wasn't like we didn't know Corey would be leaving early. It had been decided from the get-go that he would leave when we arrived in Australia. That had been the deal we'd made with Katie before leaving. She'd not been particularly supportive of the trip from the very beginning and had given him an ultimatum: either stay at home or break up with her. It was only after coming up with the idea for Corey to head home after 4 months that she agreed to let him go. Personally, I had thought the whole ultimatum was pretty selfish on her part. In order to explain my reasoning, I'll need to shed some light on the situation as a whole. You've now come to know the lighthearted, easygoing, and careless Corey that I know and love. What you haven't seen is the part of him before he met Katie. He was the same in terms of personality as he always was and probably will be. However, there was a huge difference in one specific aspect: his dislike of children and reluctance to ever have some of his own, or even go near them for that matter. This is why, when he first started seeing Katie, he was hesitant to get serious with her. She had 2 children from a previous relationship, and their father was not in the picture. In fact, his first romantic encounter with her had been an incredibly drunken night at a local bar where he accompanied her home and made nasty, dirty, drunken love to her. In the morning, he was awoken by a small toddler poking him in the gut. His eyes opened in a still tipsy haze to hear the young boy asking him, "Do you know where my mommy is?" Good question. It was only after a while that he started to become the man he was right before leaving on that trip with Aaron and me. A man, I might add, that I was immensely proud of. You see, Corey and I had been in the same boat. Almost exactly, in fact. If the listener will remember, all the way back to the beginning of this tale, I too had been clueless and, quite frankly, scared shitless of children until I had dated a girl with 2 children. 2 children who were the exact same ages of Corey's girlfriend's children, and whose fathers were also not in the picture. The similarities don't end there. We had just learned from Corey 2 days prior that Katie had cheated on him. When he had told us the news, the story of my own heartbreak came crashing back into my thoughts. Hearing his eerily similar sorrowful pining, I relived the whole thing over and over in my head. It hadn't taken long for me to fall in love with Samantha and her children, despite my apprehension at first. I loved them as my own and can honestly say, to this day, I've found no greater joy in life than when I was helping raise them. All of this came to a crashing halt when she cheated on me with baby daddy number 2, after the guy had subjected her and her daughter to countless unspeakable hardships just to be an asshole. I was crushed. I did what I'm known for doing and ran away. That time it was to the West Coast. I came back a changed man with a new outlook on life, as often happens with traveling. I was unfalteringly positive and looked at everything in my path with renewed vigor. I was happy. Just happy. I finally put the finishing touches on my house after stacks of trim boards had sat behind my couch for 2 years. I canceled my cable TV subscription in favor of remaining active, and I even started exercising. It was only a short while before Samantha began messaging me again, and before I knew it, I was right back with her. It hadn't been hard to forgive her. I was done for the first time I walked into her house again and her son ran up to hug me. I had missed her, and being a dad, even if only a stepdad, so much that I found a way to look past what she'd done to me. Then, a few months later, she cheated on me again, and the optimistic image of a happy family was torn apart once again. It went a little easier the second time around because I think I kind of expected it. I didn't come away unscathed by any means, though. The experience had long-lasting emotional consequences. For years afterwards, I found it hard to connect with women on a serious relationship level. I pushed people away and got anxious at the thought of it happening all over again. Fast forward a short while when all of my wounds were still fresh, and there I was watching Corey go through the exact same thing. "Man, I'm going to give you some advice," I told him after hearing the news about his girlfriend. "I've been there before, and I can tell you she's not going to change. Don't put yourself through what I've gone through, man. I wish I would have stayed broken up with Samantha after the first time she cheated on me. Just don't make it any harder on you, or more importantly, the kids." He wouldn't listen to reason. He somehow found a way to blame himself for her cheating on him because he was the one who had left to travel. The logic behind that still angers and bewilders me. He would later find out that she had basically started seeing the guy right after we left. Dates, dinners, shopping trips, all within 2 weeks of our departure. Unfortunately, though, the worst part of Corey's saga is yet to come. Before we get to that, though, I'll explain the events leading up to his departure. After he found this news out, he spent long hours video chatting with her as well as several friends back home who attempted to console him on the matter. An overwhelming majority, as any rational thinking person would assume, told him to forget her and enjoy the trip of a lifetime as a newly single man. He wouldn't listen to logic or reason, though. He continually asked me for advice, but I could tell his mind was made up right from the start. He wanted to go home and be with her. I would bring up the things she had done to him since we left, from downright disrespect right up to the mischievous misconduct such as, oh, say, letting another dude put his dick inside her, or letting a different guy sleep in her bed with her a few months prior. He continually stuck up for her and made excuses on how it was his fault and how he thought she was innocent. I wanted to slap him and say, "Wake up! You're blinded right now!" But I knew it was no use. I'd been there before myself. It wasn't just her he was considering. It was the children who he'd raised as his own. It was the idea of being part of a family. Sadly, I knew how it would end. She had proven that she wasn't going to respect him or remain faithful. It could only end in disaster and inevitably cause more damage to the innocent lives of the children. But if someone had tried to tell me that, and many people did, about Samantha, I would have completely ignored them, and I did. I had blinders on. The only way to find these things out is to learn them on your own. I was still not prepared when Corey actually broke the news, though. We had, I thought, convinced him to stay a couple more weeks and have more time to think about it, since we were planning to head to the southern islands of Koh Samui and Koh Phangan in just a couple days. So when he told me he was leaving tomorrow, it hit me like a brick wall. I was hurt. Crushed. I felt like my best friend had stabbed me right in the back. After all we had gone through, he was going to abandon us and leave me with Aaron, who I couldn't seem to find a way to get along with no matter how hard I tried. We had just spent over $100 on a new camera for him. Aaron had paid for a majority of his plane tickets to even come on the trip. And this was how he was repaying us for everything? Leaving us high and dry to go home to some girl that obviously didn't give two shits about his well-being? I was angry, sad, and depressed. I knew I had to be a good friend and try to understand, though. So the next night we headed to the night market and got some souvenirs for him to take home to our friends and family and called the indie animals over for a going-away party. It was bittersweet. Our seemingly billionth attempt at quitting smoking had been scheduled to start the next day, so we forfeited one of our nicotine patches to him so he could use it on the long plane flight home, which was set to route him through South Korea and across the west coast of the U.S. back to Ohio. We hugged him one last time and all posed for a picture, which the Indian almost took for us. They called up a taxi for him, and we gathered outside the hostel to wait for it. I just can't believe you're really leaving right now, before we finally get to enjoy the trip. I attempted a last-ditch plea to get him to stay. I just have to do what I think is right, man, he answered. He was going, there was no question about it. When I get back home, I'll do my best to try to help you guys out. Be careful and take care of yourselves. And don't kill each other. We laughed nervously, and Aaron and I glanced at each other with equal worry. Then the taxi pulled up, and we threw Corey's bag into the back. We had divvied up group items that he'd been carrying, so mine and Aaron's packs both gained quite a bit of weight in the past hour. Corey's was thrown easily into the taxi cab. We hugged again, and he slid into the back seat of the taxi. We watched the cab speed away with the usual Bangkok hustle and bustle of tuk-tuks, speeding buses, and little scooters. After the cab went out of sight, we turned and walked back to the hostel. My head was spinning in a whirlwind of emotions. Were Aaron and I going to be able to get along? Things had gotten slightly easier with the burden of money off our backs, which had been our primary cause for argument. But would we have enough money to make it through the rest of the trip? I knew Australia and New Zealand were going to be expensive, possibly even more expensive than Europe had been. More than anything, I was just depressed. Depressed because my friend had abandoned me with this guy who I barely got along with, and depressed that he wasn't going to be around to talk to anymore. Corey and I had the same sense of humor and almost the same personality. One of my only sources of joy during the shittier times in Europe had been when I'd found a way to laugh at it with him. Was I going to be able to do that now? I went back to my bunk and opened my laptop. I started typing away on freelancing sites, continuing the never-ending search for more money in an attempt to clear my mind. Corey's return home to Katie had, in the end, turned out even worse than I could have ever expected. Shortly after his arrival home, she dropped a bombshell on him. She was pregnant. You want to take a guess who the father was? Spoiler alert, it certainly wasn't Corey. It devastated him. What was worse, though, was the ultimatum she gave him. Her and these ultimatums. If he stayed with her and helped her out, she would keep the baby. If he chose to break up with her, however, she was going to get an abortion. Yes, you heard that correctly. That, ladies and gentlemen, is the definition of fucked up. Not being able to live with himself for being the cause of an abortion, in his gullible mind, he decided to stay with her. I suspect that she knew she was pregnant before he decided to come home, but she just chose not to tell him so that he would return. The crazy thing was, he stayed with her during this whole pregnancy, taking care of her kids, and nobody saw much of him during this period, and it wasn't until the baby was actually born that he realized he just couldn't bring himself to do it. He told her he needed some time to think about things. And what did she do? When this guy, who had done all of this endlessly selfless shit for her, told her he needed some time to think about how he was going to help her raise the baby she cheated on him to conceive, she texted him the next day and broke up with him. Thus, poor big-hearted Corey was thrown out into the world as a single man again, having wasted the rest of his trip and probably the only chance he would have to see Australia and New Zealand. All of that wasted on trying to, for a lack of better words, turn a hoe into a housewife. I wish I could say I was there to help talk him through all of this, but that's not what happened. It wasn't until I got home that I learned of most of this. Once Corey left, he essentially seemed to forget that Aaron and I even existed. I heard from him a small handful of times during the rest of the trip. In fact, it took him over 2 months to even drop off the belongings that Aaron had sent home to his parents, which was only about a 10-minute drive from where Corey spent a majority of his days. All of this, coupled with the fact that the case was similar with a large majority of my friends back home, a terrible realization was eventually made that maybe all the people I'd considered so close may not have been as close as I'd thought. It hurt. A lot. When you leave, I discovered, life just goes on without you. This seems especially true of a small town life, where if you manage to escape and enter the world at large, you're essentially considered dead for all intents and purposes. Sure, they don't write you off in anger or anything like that, but you're not around to do the same old things with your friends every weekend and thus aren't really considered much in daily thought. Out of all of my friends back home, only two or three of them regularly messaged me to ask how things were going. Fortunately for us, even if some were too busy to message us, they still showed their care and support by donating money through the website. In the end, I think that is what made the entire trip possible. If not for the donations rolling in, we'd have ran out of money soon after Europe. I always felt bad having a donation system set up, but we tried to even out this feeling by offering things in return, such as a souvenir, postcard, or a video of a song dedicated to our generous supporters. So as life turned quickly back to normality at home once we'd left our friends and family months earlier, life on the other side of the world eventually became normal without Corey. Normal as it may be, by our standards, that is. The rest of the trip would be starkly different without our optimistic, bearded friend. While the friction between Aaron and I had seemed to lessen, I often wondered how long it would last and if we'd ever make it through the rest of the trip without killing each other. End of chapter 22. Chapter 23. Island Life. Marijuana and Monkey Business. Koh Phang Yan, Thailand. You have to spray your asshole with a sink sprayer after you shit. Journal entry, September 29th, 2013. September 24th. We left Bangkok only a couple days after Corey's departure. I had asked out a local Thai girl named Luk Thao, who worked for one of the food vendor stands a day or two before we left. You could say, albeit loosely, that I had dated a carny. I invited Aaron to join us since I wasn't really expecting any romance out of the situation, and I figured he would enjoy a tour of the temples. We had a great evening out with Luk Thao, and it was a nice ending to our stay in Bangkok. Other than when I suddenly contracted some kind of respiratory infection and spent an entire day sprawled out on my bunk laboring to breathe. This was later attributed to the heavy pollution in Bangkok, which coincidentally also answered our frequent question since arriving there. Why is everyone wearing respirator masks? The answer, however disappointing it was not because of an impending zombie outbreak. No, alas, the capital city of Thailand was just that fucking dirty. To think I almost let a hooker put my dick in her mouth while I was there. Might as well have stuffed my cock in a scooter exhaust. The indie animals threw us a going-away party, don't look so surprised, and early the next morning we took a 12-hour bus ride down to the port city of Surat Thani, then boarded a ferry to Koh Samui. One night, one day, one island, one taxi, and two long ferry rides later, and we were unloading on the shore of Koh Phang Yan, an island which, when translated to English, cleverly and creatively means Island Phang Yan. I honestly have no clue what Phang Yan means. Probably booze. Booze Island. I noticed early on in our ferry ride that the island was a party place for backpackers. This was a change from our neighborhood in Bangkok, where I don't think I saw a single tourist during the entire 3 weeks or so that we were there. The same feelings arose as when I was in Rome. I felt distant from these young travelers. Ahem, tourists. We stepped off the pier and were immediately hounded by a mob of taxi cab drivers attempting to win us over for cab fare.
Hey guy, taxi ride to hostel, cheap, cheap, cheap.
They jumped in our faces and patted our shoulders emphatically. This not being our first rodeo, as the saying goes, we skipped right past these slick salesmen who were easily grabbing naive backpackers by the dozen. Farther down the road, we found a smaller group of taxi drivers laying among some coconut trees. "Taxi?" Aaron asked.
"Yee, taxi, you come."
I asked him how much. It was about half what the guys on the pier were quoting. "Take that, amateurs." He threw our backpacks onto the roof rack of a rickety-looking little Toyota pickup, a Songathowl. He motioned for us to sit on some metal benches that had been welded to the inside of the bed. I noticed he didn't tie our bags down. Instead of leaving, we sat there and waited, as, much to our dismay, he kept inviting more people over until the entire pickup was crammed with stinky backpackers. I'm including myself as one of these, of course. Then, at last, the little truck sprang to life as the driver popped the clutch and screeched onto the road. I grabbed onto a metal bar next to me. The truck screeched again as we haphazardly pulled onto the main roadway. The driver was a fucking maniac. The only two speeds he knew were NASCAR and ballistic cruise missile, and the only braking technique he knew was, "Your asshole is now in your esophagus." The young kid sitting across from me clenched the metal seat below him. I stared downward in terror, at nothing in particular, as if we were in a landing craft about to hit Omaha Beach on D-Day. We sped up the steep mountain road in a record-breaking ascent. Once we'd reached the top, we could see the entire south side of the island. We had little time to enjoy the view, however, before we were careening down the other side, taking corners as if the brakes were out. "How in the hell are all our bags staying up there?" a British backpacker wondered aloud to his girlfriend. We were all hoping for some kind of reassuring response from her that maybe we were unaware of, but were left in worrying disappointment. After the 10-minute death shuttle finally came to a sliding halt, no, seriously, in the gravel, we were ushered off the taxi while our driver threw, still speaking quite literally, all of our bags into a pile on the ground. My poor, poor laptop. We spent a considerable time walking around the island in search of our hostel, during which time I realized that I was going to like this place a lot more than Bangkok. I saw nothing but smiles, coconut and banana trees, and delicious Thai food. And everything was priced cheaper. Fucking paradise, I thought. We lucked out on our hostel as well. For a measly $2.36 per night, we were put up in a private, immaculately clean room with air conditioning and access to a warm shower. I know, a warm shower on a tropical island seems unnecessary or even undesirable. But in Bangkok, our shower had two temperatures, Antarctica and deep space. No matter how hot it was outside, that damn shower was torture. We befriended the British hostel manager named Paul, who told us during our first conversation with him that, "You can get a joint or a bag of weed up there at the reggae bar if that's your fancy. I like to smoke quite a bit myself. I'll be glad to share a spliff with you later." He later hooked us up by comping the rest of our stay in exchange for a review on a hostel booking website. On that note, Koh Phang Yan turned out to be a period of blissful relief for our bank account. Not only because things were cheaper, but also because I started to make some real money doing graphic design work. The travel blogger groups on Facebook had landed me a few jobs, and those people had referred other people, so on and so forth, until I was working relatively steadily. Now understand that I was charging insanely low rates in order to attract more clients. That being said, given our cheap cost of living, it was actually decent money to us. $40 went a long way when we were only spending about $8 to $10 a day total on living expenses. We were unwilling to spend any more desperately needed money on partying, though. After our many Bangkok bashes with the Indianimals, we figured we'd gotten that out of our system for a while anyway. With the exception of a few days where we hung out and swam at the beach and one day where we made a music video, I spent most of the daytime working. In the evenings, I downloaded movies and watched them on my laptop. Aaron spent most of his time watching movies or instant messaging with Look Tao back in Bangkok. He'd asked me before leaving the city if I cared if he added her on Facebook. "Ah, moving in on my girl, eh?" I said jokingly. He erupted in frustration. "Well, dude, you've gotten all the girls so far. I should at least get one." I was taken aback. First of all, I was kidding. I'll never see that girl again, so why would I care if you talk to her? Second, I have not had sex one time on this trip, unless you count the multiple occasions when I had sex with myself and Hammock. I don't know what you mean by saying I've gotten all the girls like they're some kind of sexual Pokemon collection. The only reason I've hung out with more women on this trip is because I've talked to them, for fuck's sake. "Well, I never know what to say when you guys are all sitting talking."
Every time I want to say something, I don't know how to get a word in. That specific conversation is when it really started to hit me that I was handling my differences with Aaron in the wrong way. I'd been angry at him for being so different. But when he said that sentence, it kind of sparked an epiphany in me. I thought back to all the times Corey and I had sat around with groups of people, drinking and laughing, while Aaron usually sat in the background, quietly sipping on his drink. I thought about all the conversations we'd had in the nature preserve, where Corey and I would reminisce about funny things we'd done with our friends over the years, while Aaron only brought up stories involving his cousins or brothers. The poor kid had never been allowed to do anything. His parents kept him so sheltered from life that he never had a chance to interact with other kids growing up like I had. They sent him to that damn Catholic school, where apparently they taught him that red meat and salt is like super good for you, and told him his whole life that their opinions about the world were irrefutable facts, effectively keeping him from questioning or learning things on his own. In my opinion, and that's all this is my opinion, all of that sheltering had caused him to be unable to perform well in teamwork scenarios, which had been effectively demonstrated time and time again. By his own admission, he had had trouble interacting socially. He didn't have knowledge of basic scientific beliefs on many topics. He had been led to believe that money was more important than life experiences and memories. Under all of this backwardness, as I saw it, I saw a glimpse of a guy who wanted to experience more of life. He just didn't know how. Not only that, but he'd been programmed to feel guilty about it, as per the standard religious norm. If it feels good, then God will probably punish you eternally for it. For the first time, I felt truly bad for Aaron. I also felt bad about how much of a dickhead I'd been to him on some things. Yes, he was absolutely ridiculous about a lot of the things that we argued over. But now I realized he probably didn't even realize how ridiculous he was being. On top of that, he didn't know how to handle it when he was forced to cooperate with other people on a team project, and especially share his money with the group as we'd all agreed to do. Given all of this, in his eyes, I was the weird one. I went almost instantly from viewing Aaron as someone I had to deal with as someone I wanted to, I don't know, help. I know that sounds crazy, given that I'm a piss-poor example of adult accomplishment or success. I'm not exactly the pinnacle of excellence, if you will. But damn it, I enjoy the shit out of life. And I wanted to help Aaron learn how to do that too. I wanted him to learn that there's more to life than money in a box under your bed. That it's good to let your emotions out now and then, rather than bottle them up until you explode, as he'd done in the Tiber Creek campground hostel underneath my drunkenly built sheep fort. I wanted him to learn that he was 26 years old now, no longer under the control of his parents, and he could live his life how he damn well pleased. I had finally realized, after all these weeks, that there was nothing wrong with him. He was simply different than me. Later that evening, I apologized to him for how I'd handled everything thus far, and I told him that I was going to do better with learning to accept our differences. He empathetically admitted that he'd been at fault of doing the same with me, surprisingly, and we shook hands and decided that maybe we could get along after all. That night when I went to bed, I felt like a huge weight had lifted off my shoulders. I hoped our truce would last and that we'd both come out of the whole thing as better men for having learned to accept each other. We spent a little over a week on the paradise island that was Koh Phangan. The time passed by quickly as we settled into a routine. As it had been in Bangkok, it was cheaper to eat at restaurants on the island than it was to shop at grocery stores. We tried a different Thai dish every night, and I don't think I had a single one that was disappointing. One day we decided to rent a scooter and explore the island. Yes, one scooter. We were still poor, after all, so instead of opting for a pair of scooters to tour the island on, we paired up like a happy couple and I held onto the back of the scooter while Aaron drove. We planned to visit some of the island's waterfalls, but were disappointed to find that they had all been reduced to a trickle during a recent dry spell. we were able to stop and play around with an elephant for a bit and get some pictures with it. I saw that he was chained to a stake on the ground and could only wander a few feet in any direction. It made me sad and got me thinking about some of the other things I'd seen in Asia. I hoped that they at least enjoyed their jungle walks with the tourists. But I decided I wouldn't be patronizing any more businesses that involved animal tourism or sex tourism or anything that could cause a human or animal to have to suffer. After leaving the elephants, we came upon an Israeli couple who had wrecked their scooter on the mountain trail. The woman was banged up pretty bad, and I gave some bandages from the first aid kit I'd thrown in my backpack before leaving the hostel. They seemed grateful, but there wasn't much more we could offer them. Hopefully they made it back to population without further incident. We got lost a couple of times afterwards and ended up checking out a picturesque little restaurant situated in a beautiful hidden cove along the beach. A gay dinner for a gay scooter ride, I suppose. While eating at the restaurant, I watched out across the road as a group of workers harvested coconuts in a very interesting manner. They had monkeys tied to little leashes next to them. I watched as one of the workers untied the little monkey, which promptly scurried up the tall coconut tree and knocked all the coconuts off, which the workers then picked up and threw into the bed of a rusty pickup. After all the coconuts had been dropped from the tree, the little monkey would climb back down and return to his owner. After the pickup truck was filled, they'd leash the monkeys in the bed, give them each a treat, and take off with the day's haul. I'm sure the monkeys were quite disappointed when they learned they wouldn't be keeping their harvest. We'd been cigarette-free for a couple days before leaving Bangkok. I quit cold turkey, but Aaron again insisted on weaning himself off slowly, only smoking a few a day. I had pleaded with him not to do this, as it had consistently failed miserably in the past, see, picking up old dirty butts and rolling them into cigarettes in the nature preserve. But he insisted he could do it this time. I at last got him to agree not to buy any more packs and just smoke the rest of what we had left. Of course, as had happened before in Europe, he always seemed to have just a little bit of tobacco left tucked away in his pack somewhere. It made it very hard not to give in to temptation and smoke when I had to watch him light up every so often. But this time I stuck to my guns. Eventually, after a couple days on Koh Phi Phen, he ran out of his hoarded stash of stale tobacco. We had finally quit smoking. After several days were spent getting to know our new surroundings, we decided we should start planning our next moves for the long term. There were several options that we were considering. One thing was becoming clear. Online income aside, we were not going to be able to make it much longer without either a boost in finances or a severe deflation of living expenses. Given how low our expenses already were, it didn't seem like we could get much lower. Aaron researched several small islands in Indonesia on which we could stay in a beach hut for a couple months and save a ton of money. The only problem was that a lot of them didn't have any internet connection, which would prevent me from continuing to work online. There was also the added complication of actually getting to a tiny fucking island in Indonesia, which looked to be no small task. You were either hiring a small boat or a small airplane. I thought back to the rusty Toyota pickup that had brought us to our hostel, then to the rusty boat that had ferried us to the island. I imagined a small airplane in Indonesia. It probably consisted of a lawnmower blade strapped to an old rowboat with huge palm fronds for wings. Then I watched in my imagination as the small Indonesian man would throw our bags onto a little basket on the top and motioned for us to sit in little lawn chairs bungee-strapped to the contraption. "We should, take a boat if we're going to do that," I commented. On another note, Aaron's aspirations of becoming an Australian miner were dashed when he learned that you have to pay fees and spend a significant amount of time working to acquire a visa. In the end, the logistics just didn't make it a viable option. We knew we were headed to Malaysia within a few days when our Thai visas ran out, so we sent couchsurfing requests to hosts in the country and researched hostels and guest houses.
Aaron spotted a killer deal at a small travel agency on our current island, which would take us from our hostel, they would pick us up in a van at the front door, to a guest house in Malaysia. More good news was yet to come. When Corey had left, Katie had paid for his plane ticket, leaving an unused ticket from Australia to Los Angeles. We hadn't booked anything between Thailand and Australia, planning instead to figure out a way there as we went. I realized we may be entitled to some cash because of this, so I contacted our travel agent. Surprisingly, given the ridiculous amount of effort it had taken to try and change our tickets in Europe, she very quickly canceled Corey's last ticket and refunded the ticket price to my account. The ticket price that was close to $1,000. We were elated. Since Aaron had paid for the majority of that ticket, we got almost all of that. Corey got a little money from it after we took out what he owed Aaron. That was around the last time I heard from him until I made it back to the States. I took this time to count up our total assets. Aaron's cash still in his hidden compartment in his belt, and my PayPal account and bank account, the latter of which now holding Corey's refunded ticket money. We were doing better than we thought, although it also caused us to realize at this point that there was definitely no fucking way we were going to make it another 6 or 8 months. After much, much deliberation, we decided to cut the whole show short. Instead of going to Indonesia and living out a couple months as coconut-cracking tribesmen, we'd fly out of Malaysia from Kuala Lumpur in a few weeks and head straight to Perth, Australia, where we'd spend a month. Then we'd fly to New Zealand for a short 2-week stay there, arriving in the States by mid-November and returning home in Ohio by Christmas. Even though we were cutting the trip short, Aaron and I both felt overwhelmed with relief and joy. It had been a huge stress, thinking about how we were going to make it through the rest of the trip on such a small amount of money. With the funds we had left and the shortened length of the rest of the journey, I calculated that we'd have enough to live comfortably for the rest of the trip, provided we could find free places to stay in Australia and New Zealand, that is. Words can't describe how much better I felt when we decided to do all this. We quickly booked our plane tickets from Kuala Lumpur to Perth and messaged friends and family back home to tell them to expect us by Christmas. Then Aaron suggested a dangerous game. We should buy a few cigarettes to celebrate. Now, hear him out at least. The local convenience store sold little 5-cigarette mini-packs as well as the usual 20. Aaron reasoned that, since this was such a jovial occasion, we could smoke a measly, paltry, inconsequential 5 cigarettes. I paused for a moment and thought about it. I knew it was a bad idea, given that we'd pretty much made it through the rough patch of quitting smoking by this point, but this was just 5 cigs. Not 20, which would certainly leave us addicted once again, but a mere 5. Which would be totally fine. I'll go grab them, I said. I rushed down to the convenience store. I shucked off my shoes at the entrance mat and hurriedly scampered towards the sweet forbidden nicotine like a nefarious raccoon. Upon reaching the counter, I immediately noticed that the shelf, which usually held the smaller packs, was empty. Where are the little packs? I asked the Thai clerk. No small pack, only big pack left. I considered my options. On one hand, I knew that if I bought a full pack of 20 cigarettes, we'd soon be smokers again. On the other hand, I already had my mind set on smoking a cigarette. My mouth salivated. All right, give me a pack. Now, hear me out at least. I figured I could just take out 5 cigarettes and then throw the rest of the pack away without telling Aaron. I knew if he saw the whole pack, we'd end up smoking them and it would be all over for our nicotine cessation. After all, it was only $1 for a whole pack. Better to throw them away and not have to worry about it. I removed the 5 cigarettes and held them in one hand, with the rest of the pack in the other hand, as I walked back towards the hostel. I saw a lone trash can sitting by the road. I stopped at it, holding the pack over the opening. I tried to release my grip on them, but my brain just wouldn't let me do it. I stared at the pack in deep concentration. Just a flimsy rectangle of thin cardboard holding 15 paper tubes filled with dried tobacco. That's it. That's all it is, I thought. Then I imagined that moment when the smoke entered my lungs. Heavenly, calming, blissful smoke. This was my moment. This was where I was either a man of mental fortitude who stuck to his convictions, or where I caved and gave in to temptation like a careless child. You've been hearing this story long enough to know what I did. After stashing the almost full pack on top of an air conditioning unit which was mounted next to our second story porch, I entered the hostel room with the other 5 cigarettes. Aaron's face lit up with joy like a kid on Christmas morning. Did you get him? I got him! Come on! We both practically skipped outside to light the cigarettes. Shortly thereafter, we both sat on the railing to keep from falling over with dizziness. Fucking fantastic, wonderful, majestic nicotine. That night, before I went to sleep, I innocently mentioned to Aaron that I was going out to the bathroom to, quote, poop, which actually was just an excuse to grab my secret pack of cigarettes off of the air conditioning unit and smoke half of one. The next day, I repeated the act while Aaron was watching a movie on his laptop. We had been rationing our 5 cigarettes, but with my sneaking off to, quote, poop, in between those shared with Aaron, I had quickly become addicted again. As if I'd ever truly beaten the addiction. I'd only delayed it for a while. I mean, come on. Anyway, after a day or two of this, I'd still really only smoked 3 or so cigarettes from the pack, considering I had only been smoking a little bit of each one. I decided that that was it. I couldn't go the rest of the trip sneaking cigarettes behind Aaron's back. I fought the urge from then on and let the pack sit untouched on the air conditioning unit. In retrospect, I don't know why I didn't just throw them away. I did good with it, though, and didn't even touch them once for a full day. On that second day, however, things got interesting. Dude! Aaron came running into the hostel room while I was working on my laptop. What? I asked excitedly, unsure what he was so pumped about. You're not going to believe this. Someone threw a full pack of cigarettes off the balcony. It's just laying on that big scrap pile by the bathroom. My eyes widened in worried astonishment. Surely not. Are you sure it's not just an empty pack? I asked innocently. Nope. I can see right into it how it landed. It's almost full. But, I mean, well, how are you going to get over there, though? Isn't it behind a fence? I'll go down and hop it then. Well, shit. I followed him out to the balcony where he excitedly pointed to my forlorn pack of cigarettes, which had apparently fallen from the top of the air conditioning unit at some point during the night. Sure enough, the top was wide open and several cigarettes could be seen poking out. I had no choice but to play dumb with him. No way! Why would someone leave a full pack of cigarettes down there? I know, right? And they're even our brand. Someone must have left them sitting on this balcony ledge right here, and they must have just fallen off. Yep, I bet that is exactly what happened. Aaron wasted no time in deftly hopping the fence and grabbing the pack. We each lit up a cigarette. So, we're pretty much smoking again then, right? Nah, man, we'll quit after this pack is done. Before leaving Copenhagen, we were full-fledged smokers again. The funniest thing about this incident, to me, is that I never told Aaron what had really happened. To this day, he still thinks that pack just somehow ended up on the scrap pile. So, Aaron, as you're hearing this for the first time, possibly already planning my demise for printing our variance disagreements in Europe, along with all the Catholic jokes, I'm sorry, I just couldn't help myself. But shit, if you hopped over a damn fence and onto a trash pile to get half a pack of cigarettes because of your addiction, well, I can't be held in too much disregard for failing to throw it away in the first place because of mine, right? End of chapter 23. Chapter 24. Cheeseburgers, poop ditches, and Buddhist monks from Spain. Penang, Malaysia. A good traveler has no fixed plans and is not intent on arriving. Lao Tzu. October 3rd. It was a hellacious bus ride from Surat Thani, after the ferries from the islands, all the way down to some border town I can't remember the name of, where we stayed in a hostel that looked like it had been abandoned 50 years earlier. The bathroom was interesting. What was really weird to me was the, quote, shitting system. I call it this because I wouldn't quite call it a toilet, while at the same time, it wasn't one of those holes in the floor that you see a lot of in Southeast Asia. It was a set of pink-tiled steps which led up to a platform about 3 feet off the ground. The thing looked like a Mayan temple or something. There was a hole at the top, and the person was expected to hover on the slippery tile over the hole while gripping a handle on the wall. After finishing their business, the person would spray his or her asshole clean with a little sink sprayer hanging on the wall. With the slippery tile already a danger factor for ending up in a poop hole, the water spraying part only added to the excitement and adventure. I refrained from taking a number two during our stay there. Now, if you did fall down into Montezuma's poop pyramid, then don't be too worried. There was a shower in there as well. A small sink sprayer hanging from a rusty clothes hanger which was screwed into the plaster wall next to the sink. There was no stall or anything like that. Just the sprayer, the sink, and the poop fortress towering over everything in the corner of the room. After staying in that palace of feces and gloom for one night, we were ushered onto a crammed bus with a bunch of local Thai and Malay travelers. We spent most of the day bouncing around on the road south. At one point, the bus stopped, and we were directed to get off and walk across the border to Malaysia. Our passports were stamped, and then we were reboarded on the bus on the other side. Finally, hours later, we were dropped off in the middle of a busy street on the island of Penang, or Georgetown if you're a colonial. As happened a lot on the trip, given that each of our packs weighed roughly the equivalent of an aircraft carrier, one of us volunteered to sit with the gear while another went in search of our hostel. As also happened a lot in the trip, the hostel we had booked online turned out to be nowhere near as picturesque as the photos had shown. In Italy, when we had booked a short two-night stay in Rome to get a break from nature preserve life, we spent a couple extra euros so we could get an air-conditioned room. We never found a heat quite like we'd had in Italy. Not even in Malaysia, right smack dab next to the equator, was it that hot. So we had sprung for a room with AC, only to find out on our arrival that there was none. "Where's the air conditioning?" Aaron had asked. The little Chinese lady who ran the hostel pointed to a small, oscillating fan in a corner of the room. "Have three speed. Button on top, make it move back and forth. A fucking fan." At that point in our sorry excuse of a trip, we just laughed it off and chalked it up to another folly of European cultural differences. What more could we do? But now, after several weeks in Southeast Asia, we were used to living like kings. This hostel wasn't up to par with our aristocratic tastes. For one thing, the shower was, I swear, coated in AIDS or hepatitis or something. They required you to take off your shoes before entry into the building, but the floors were chronically devoid of any kind of janitorial attention. The biggest problem for me was that the Wi-Fi connection didn't work at all upstairs, inconveniently where a small workstation and our rooms were located. So we had to sit downstairs by the big entrance outside. It was exceptionally hot there, and the mosquitoes absolutely swarmed, in an area that poses a significant risk of malaria. Now, none of this would be a problem for a short stay, but we were looking for a place to call home for the next week or two. Were we expected to deal with this filth and peasantry? Scoff. The decision was quickly made to find another hostel. I found a spot online that looked great in pictures, but given our current situation, I wanted to check it out in person. On the walk over, I made an earth-shattering discovery. You see, for the past month or two, I had been desperately craving something from back home. Something that, deep in our nation's core, just screams America and all that is manliness. Something that, coupled with beers and some buddies, could only be beset on an American flag with eagles soaring overhead. something just as American as the 4th of July and apple pie. A cheeseburger. A bacon cheeseburger. Not a shitty McDonald's one, but a thick, juicy, cholesterol-packed heart stopper. But alas, these Western patties of salty splendor are not available to the poor, cheeseburger-deprived Asians. At least, not that I could find. And let me tell you, I looked. I thought about them all the time. Now don't get me wrong, I absolutely loved the Thai food. But after you eat rice and chicken or some variation of that for weeks on end, you start craving something different. Or in my case, something familiar. Oh, how I missed burgers dearly. I even drew pictures of them in my little journal. Little sesame seed buns housing a juicy slab of ground beef with cheese overflowing from the sides and bacon hanging out. Lettuce, red onion, all of it along with some crispy fries. So you can imagine my overwhelming joy when I rounded a corner in fucking Penang, Malaysia, and saw a small stand with a sign that read, American Cheeseburgers and Hot Dogs. My legs became wobbly and I held onto the side of a building for support. Aaron, oh my God, I can't. Are you all right? Cheeseburgers. Fucking, there's cheeseburgers, dude. Oh, is it? Oh my God, is it real? Is it some kind of mirage? I pointed out the stand to him and we approached it. He wasn't nearly as excited as I was, which is understandable. I was in a state of perpetual bliss over what I was about to enjoy. There was a large line of younger locals waiting for their little taste of heaven. I would have waited hours without so much as a complaint. After a couple minutes it started to rain, tropical Malaysian rain that is akin to having dump trucks of water poured on you in a matter of milliseconds. Aaron retreated to the shitty mosquito hostel and I volunteered to grab his food. I didn't care about the rain. You could have stabbed me in the face right there and I would have waited to get my cheeseburger before I let the ambulance cart me away to a hospital. The earth could have been ending by a meteor strike, and a small spaceship could have swooped down to save a handful of Earth's inhabitants, and I wouldn't have moved from the line. Give me a second, I've almost got my burger, I would have said. After finally arriving at the front of the line, soaking wet and just as happy as I'd been the first time I saw a pair of tits, I ordered a double cheeseburger with bacon, lettuce, and onion along with some French fries. You want cheese? The man asked. You stupid, fickle little man. Of course I want goddamn cheese. We no have bacon. What fresh hell is this? How are you going to sit there running a cheeseburger stand and tell me you don't have fucking bacon? You want extra lettuce? I took out my pocket knife and I stabbed him in the jugular, right then and there. All right, maybe that entire conversation was a tad overdramatized. He told me they didn't have bacon and I quietly hung my head in despair and said, okay. After receiving my precious burger and a heap of fries in a small bag, I scurried back to the hostel. If people came too close to me, I hissed and growled at them like a mountain lion protecting her cubs. I ran upstairs and sat the bag down on the little table that was in the common room. Aaron! Burgers are here! I yelled for him in the bunk room. He walked out, still only slightly interested. I unwrapped my beautiful treasure and stared at it for a moment. For weeks, I have waited for this moment. I bit into the burger. My hopes dropped through the floor and into the depths of fiery, torturous hell. I grimaced. This thing tastes like a fucking hot dog. Exactly like a hot dog. How's that even possible? Aaron took a bite of his. Yep, hot dog. This wasn't a burger. This was a disgrace. I thought about calling our embassy and telling them that American dignity had been attacked ruthlessly here on Georgetown Island. Send in the fucking Apache helicopters and tanks, because these clowns were downright insulting us. I wanted to walk back to the burger stand and impale the sorry excuse for a cook in the chest with an American flag. Instead, I scarfed down the rest of the burger along with the fries without a further word of complaint. And then, for the next two nights, ate there again. Sorry, guys, it was still kind of a burger. Just after I'd finished the hot dog burger, a young guy with a short and bushy beard walked up the stairs.
"Hey, guys, is it back that way to the rooms?" he asked and pointed down the hallway behind Aaron and me. "Yeah, man, it's just down there and on your right," I answered. He paused for a moment. "Is this a good place? I was just walking down the street and saw that it was very cheap, so I said, what the hell?" "Well, to be honest, it's pretty bad, man. We're getting the hell out of here tomorrow and going to a nicer place we saw." We talked to the guy, Mark, for a moment and learned that he was from Spain and had just arrived in Malaysia from neighboring Myanmar, formerly known as Burma. I'm not one of those types of people that talk about energy or whatever, but this guy put off some kind of really good, laid-back vibe with me. Which was why, when he asked within only a couple of minutes of meeting him if we would mind if he traveled with us for a while, I answered with no hesitation at all. "Sure, man, that's fine with me. We'd love to have someone along." Aaron agreed, and we offered to share a private room with him at the guest house we were heading to the next day. All of us liked the idea of having a cleaner room with actual beds and privacy for cheaper than we were paying for a dorm room full of people and a bathroom with MRSA showers, so it was a no-brainer. The three of us walked down to the guest house to set up our room for the next couple nights there. The short, probably 4'10" girl running the counter seemed friendly, as did a small man running around who appeared to be the manager. Again, I got a very good feeling about them within only a few minutes of meeting them. She showed us the room along with clean-looking showers. Mark spoke up after seeing the room. "You know, guys, it's very cheap price for this room. What do you think about just coming here tonight, even though we already paid for the room at the other hostel?" "You read my mind," I said. Aaron was on the same page as well. We set everything up and returned with all of our bags. We got to know Mark very well over the next few days. I have to say, out of all the people I met during my months traveling that year, he was probably the person I connected with the most. He was just a cool, level-headed dude. We always seemed to be on the same page about everything. The story of his journey before meeting us was crazy. He'd gone to Thailand on holiday and decided to make a visa run to Myanmar with a friend. It was there that he learned he could live in Buddhist monasteries for free as long as he practiced meditation. He figured he would give it a try, so he stayed at one. All said and done, he ended up living in several different monasteries for a total of 6 months. He'd spend hours and hours every day just meditating. The rules of the monasteries were strict. No talking, no eating other than at mealtimes, no cigarettes, even no masturbating. You were given breaks throughout the day, but upwards of 10 hours each day was spent in silent meditation. Mark led us in several group meditations to teach us what it was all about. I loved it. I felt like I had a natural high afterwards, like I was floating or something. It leaves you with a feeling of reverent contentedness, like you have an aura of happiness around you. Each session was about 30 minutes or so. Mark would direct us to focus our thoughts on a particular body part for several moments. Forehead. Nose. Lips. Chin. Etc. Until we had worked down our entire bodies and back up. The result would sometimes be tingling sensations in these body parts as we followed along with the exercise. I was thoroughly impressed with all of it. He was going to teach us some yoga as well, but we never quite got around to it. We met up with an Australian couple who were also staying in the guest house. Mark started talking to them originally, as they'd been practicing meditation at workshops in the area. Jenny and Tom had just been married and were starting 6 years of uninterrupted travel. We got along famously with them, and the five of us frequented the guest house restaurant daily to sit and chat. There were some times when conversations between Mark and the newlyweds would drift out of my grasp of understanding. But simply, sometimes shit got weird. There was one time where they were talking about being able to use mind control or something of the sort, and were staring at each other with laser eyes. One of them would say, "Oh, I felt that," or, "Are you concentrating on my leg? I can feel the energy in my leg."
The whole episode was lost on me, but they weren't crazy or anything like that. Aaron seemed like he got along with that group better than any of the previous groups that we'd hung out with. It probably helped that none of us